Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Renee. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Thanks for joining us today. I hope everybody had a great weekend. It was kind of a sun to storm weekend. One minute you'd look outside and it was so bright, it was almost difficult to look at the sky. And then 10 minutes later, it would be black. So it was an interesting an interesting weekend. I have a couple things that I have been kind of putting on the back burner the last couple of weeks. People send me articles all the time, and I kind of research them and check them out before I want to talk about them. But these are interesting, and they're, one is the origin of The Wizard of Oz, and I found it to be amusing. I don't put a lot of substance in it as far as truth is concerned, but it is interesting. So I wanna discuss that, Shelley and I, this morning, so that you can hear it. I just think it's interesting, I guess is the best word. And the other thing is an article that was sent to me a couple different times and a while back, and I put it on the back burner, and then it got sent to me again, and it's about Lee Marvin, the actor, and Bob Keeshan, who's known as Captain Kangaroo, and Mr. Rogers, from the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood. And I thought, what on earth do these three guys have in common when I first looked at the article? And it ended up being very interesting. I did, however, I snoped it, like I do a lot of things that I'm sent that I don't know what the origin is. And what they write about Mr. Rogers is not factual. But the other two are. And I thought it gives us an opportunity to look at two people that I'm pretty sure everybody knows who they are from a totally different point of view. So I'm going to bring Shell in, and we're going to talk about the story about Lee Marvin and Bob Keeshan and Mr. Rogers first. Good morning, Shell.
Well, good morning, Renee. How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good. Had a nice weekend.
That's good. That's good. My weekend was challenging. There's a good word for this morning.
I'm aware of that.
I might as well bring this up because I think sometimes when I sound like I'm really not focused, it's a good idea for everybody to know maybe why. My second son, Michael, many, many years ago, 1982, was hit by a car, and I've told that story before. And I've also shared with everybody that in the last couple years, a lot of these injuries have kind of re-manifested themselves in his life. And a year ago, August, I told everybody on the show that he was in Miami having surgery, and they opened up his trachea, dilated it because of the damage done by being intubated when he was only 13 when he got hit by the car. And they also found, when they did x-rays and stuff, that he had a, in his cervical spine, it was so narrow that it was ready to break. So they did surgery on both areas of his neck on the same day. The doctor went in, put a plate in his cervical spine, and fused those vertebrae that were starting to dislodge and reinforced it with a plate. And while they were in there, the ENT, the otolaryngologist, went in and he cleaned out, lasered out what he could in the soft tissue in Mike's trachea and dilated it. Well, that lasted almost a year. About 2 months ago, Mike started having lots of trouble breathing again. And like we've talked about many, many times on the show, a lot of times when you have physical problems, they're being manifested by a little bit more psychological stuff, stress, the fact that you are being put in a place some days to deal with things that you really don't have any answers for. When you become an adult, that can be incredibly stressful because you believe if you're in charge of your family and you're one of the patriarch or the matriarch of your family, that it's up to you to be able to come up with solutions. This can be very stressful. And I think that's what's happened to Mike over the last couple of years because his family has been under tremendous stress and duress. So he had a doctor's appointment last week, and he called me, and he goes, "Mom, Valerie has to work. Mikey has to use the car because he has to take the baby, their grandchild, to the doctor's because he's having stuff done to his club feet." So I said, "Sure, honey, no problem. I'll take you." It's all the way in Miami, so that's the day that I didn't do the show. We left here at 6 o'clock in the morning, Friday morning, and got down to Miami and went in and were told that the appointment was the day before. So on the ride, now I've spent time with Mike several occasions in the last couple months. I knew he was under some duress. He told me, and this is his MO, I'm fine. But in the car with no other people, with no other conversation, with nothing else going on, I was able to really observe how labored his breathing is again. And I've noticed the motor skills, gradually being more and more impaired. So we had to walk a long way to get to the doctor's office down at the University of Miami Hospital, where Jackson Memorial and the Ryder Trauma Center and Sylvester Clinic, I mean, it's huge down there. And by the time we got there, he sounded like he was breathing through an opening that was maybe, if we were lucky, a quarter of an inch wide. So we get in there and they tell us this, and I said, "You know, we drove all the way from West Palm. Isn't there somebody my son could see? Because his breathing is really bad. And we just walked a long way to get here," and the young man at the desk, they were wonderful, by the way, at this big organization called, I think they call it University of Miami Complex or something like that. But it's all these hospitals, and they're all connected. Even the VA hospital is there. So they went running around and came back out, and there's no ENTs on duty day because we didn't have any of those appointments except for who's over in the hospital. So a nurse came out, and she asked us what was going on, and I told her, she said, "Let me call Dr. Sargi." So she did. She walks back out, and she says, "Dr. Sargi said, wait here. She wants to see Michael, or he wants to see Michael." So we did. Within a half hour, we were in Dr. Sargi's office. He took one look at my son and said, "I want you to go over and take him to the emergency room at University of Miami Hospital. We'll go straight from the emergency room to the operating room." I went, "What?" And he said, "We have to get him in right away. This is a major emergency." So we did just that. I called Valerie and Mikey. And by the time they got there, we were sitting in the emergency room, and we went from the emergency room into the operating room. Dr. Sargi comes out after about 45 minutes and says to me, "You can't ever do this again. If I hadn't been here today, if I hadn't come in, you would have lost your son today." So after I regained my composure, I said, "What did you do?" And he said, "Well, I fixed it for the time being. I saved his life, but it's not a permanent fix." So Mike is still there. Mike and Valerie and I stayed for a while when he came out of the recovery room, and he was in ICU. So I came home and downtown Miami on a Friday night. It took me 4 hours to get from Miami to here. Nice ride. Don't want to tell you all how many four-letter words I use because I didn't even know that I knew some of them. So we got home, and I brought Mikey with me because he had an appointment. And next morning, I get ready to go back to the hospital and thinking I'm going to bring my comb with me. I get there, and we're sitting there for a few hours, and he's doing better, but he's very, very swollen and pretty uncomfortable. So the long and short of it, I spent the night at University of Miami Hospital Saturday night because Valerie was working and has to have her job. So I spent the night, and yesterday we thought he was going to be able to come home then. And they didn't let him come home. So now they're talking about possibly letting him come home today. So it's really on my mind, folks, and I do want to talk about these other things because they're kind of upbeat and kind of tell you a little bit about not judging a book by its cover all the time and thinking you know somebody when you don't. So we are going to talk about that, but I did want to put that out there. I know a lot of friends listen to the show, a lot of local people who know Mike as well. So as we speak, hopefully Valerie went after I came home late last night. Well, about, I don't know, I guess I got here at about 5:30, 6 o'clock last night. And Valerie went down and stayed there last night with him because we thought after I left, they said, oh, you might be able to go home. So Val, of course, shot right down, left work early and shot right down to get him, and he still couldn't come home. So as we speak, hopefully he'll get to come home sometime today. So after the show and after taking Big Spike for his stuff today, I will go down and hopefully bring Michael home. But it looks as though we have a long road in front of us. So I ask for everybody's prayers and blessings. That always helps a lot, a lot, a lot. We know that. So I think it's going to be kind of a bumpy road for a little while. So, Michelle, do you have any questions? Is there anything I left out that you think everybody might want to know?
Did he go through a subsequent surgery or just the one procedure the day you guys got there?
No. What they did was they went inside and opened his trachea with balloons to dilate it. But his trachea, because of all of the trauma since he was 13, is no longer the soft, pliable, like cartilage and tissue that our tracheas are. His has got severe stenosis, which means it's getting hard and narrowing as we speak.
Right.
And most of the damage is done beneath his vocal cords. When the doctor did the endoscopy in the office, you know, he let me watch everything and I could see everything. Mike had an opening of about the edge of a dime.
Wow.
That he was trying to breathe through. And he, lots of swelling besides this. I mean, because, you know, it's like muscle in there and tissue. And lots of fluid because, you know, I've kind of taught Big Spike this, too, from all the stuff that he's had to his head and neck. And I tried to explain this to Michael, and we've talked about it on the show. Whenever our bodies are in duress, our bodies, all on their own, send fluid to that area.
Right.
That's why things swell up. It's usually not tissue that's swollen. It's usually because there's water in there, because our body, like, sends a message that says, you know, Rini just fell on her knee. Let's send some fluid over there to kind of pat it so she doesn't hurt it again while it repairs itself. So you could see that in his throat. I mean, lots of liquid, saliva, and also a lot of mucus, which makes it even worse. So, no, the answer to that is the surgery in August and then Friday. And now they're just letting it kind of untraumatize. But
okay,
the road ahead.
They were considering a tracheotomy that night, remember?
Yes. Well, and that almost happened Friday.
Wow.
And he said to me, if I can't do anything else, and I said, well, of course, you know, because nobody wants a tracheotomy. Nobody. Nobody wants to have something like that in their neck. He said it would be one thing if he was 80 and I was just making him comfortable, but he's 44. And he said, but there are other options. So, of course, we will be discussing those in the weeks to come. And it's ultimately Mike's decision. But
at least he's out. At least he's got some relief now. So that's good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would say, for all intensive purposes, now he's out of the immediate danger.
Right.
So, but it's kind of hard to explain to people because you think of the inside of your body, because it's inside, except for your bones, of course, as being stuff that you can, like, bend and move, and stents and things like that can be put in. People have their arteries and vessels and things like that. I said to the doctor, I said, how can you put a flexible stent in my husband's aorta? Because he's got a severe aneurysm that is actually covering the section where the aorta sends blood to his kidneys and stuff. How can you make a specialized stent and not be able to do that for Mike's trachea? And he smiled at me. He says, you almost know enough to be dangerous. And I said, tell me about it. I said, I get it. I know that and then without any education in regard to it, it makes you kind of like not very helpful a lot of times, because things seem so simple to us, you know. After we see one thing that is able to be applied, then, I mean, your common sense tells you, well, why can't you do that there? And he said, it's just different. And I said, I don't get it. And he goes,
it's
I know.
Areas of the body, that you're not really comparing apples to oranges, but without understanding the anatomy of the body and the difference in different types of tissues, what I think is amazing is that if you can have like these like CSI specialists, they can look at a piece of tissue on a slide and tell you what organ it is, because they're all different, which I find fascinating. You know,
me too.
So, and
me
the too. Different types of tissue respond differently to different type of procedures. So that, you know, so just because it can work in one area of the body doesn't mean it can work in another area of the body, because it's a different type of tissue. It doesn't respond the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like I said, because it's got, I guess, like a cartilage or something in it. You know what
right.
I keep thinking of? I keep thinking of like a turkey neck. You know,
mm-hmm.
when you're going to cook, I mean, and it's solid. It's when you see it after a turkey has been, you know, processed and everything, but you still have the whole turkey there and you have a turkey neck. I keep imagining that in my mind's eye and thinking to myself, well, if it's got, because it's very flexible. You can see that when you go in with the endoscopy. You see the pulsating and the breathing, and when you make a noise, you see the opening of the trachea open up. You can see the vocal cords. You see the vocal cords pull together to make the noise. I mean, it's incredibly interesting. So it seems like, you know, there's stuff you can do, because it's
right.
a living organism. So you, and apparently there is, and of course it's come just, you know, such a long way since 1982.
Oh, yeah.
That I suspect that, and this guy is really on top of his game. The doctor that helped Mike when he was a little boy, I called him when this happened to Mike, and he's the one who sent us to Dr. Sargi in Miami. So, you know, we have, of course, lots of good thoughts that this will all work out and still be keep Mike in a place where he's in a good place, you know, where he doesn't
right.
feel like he's not capable and able to, you know, be a part of everything, I guess is the right way to look at it. And right now he's in a good frame of mind, I would say, and he just really wants to come home, because he doesn't like being away from everybody. He and Val are very, very close, so it's hard on him when he's not around Val.
Aww.
So, But again, you know, I will give everybody updates and keep everybody posted on the rest of that story. But I don't know, being on the radio anymore is like just having a really, really, really big family. So coming on the show today and not sharing all of this seemed like I was keeping a secret. And I don't know, I just was more comfortable with sharing with most of this with everybody. So, but I found this story that I was sent that, I don't know, it kind of made me feel like, see, we all think we know everybody. Like the times, well, you see it on Facebook a lot. You know the girl that you picked on. This is what's going on with her, and you didn't know it, and you picked on her anyway. So it was interesting to read this because I thought to myself, it is funny how we are so, not always in a bad way either. You know, when you say judgmentality, you think somebody's being a jerk. And, you know, deciding that somebody's this, this, and this because of what you can see visually, and you're so often wrong. But the name of the article, sadly, is called Why Mr. Rogers Wore a Sweater. And the whole part about Mr. Rogers ended up being, they made it a catchphrase just to get people's attention. I don't know. But the part about Mr. Rogers I found to be not factual. But it starts out, Captain Kangaroo passed away on January 23, 2004, at age 76, which is odd because he always looked to be 76. He was born in 1927. His death reminded me of the following story. Some people have been a bit offended by an actor, Lee Marvin, is buried in a grave alongside 3- and 4-star generals at Arlington Cemetery. His marker gives his name, rank private, and service USMC, nothing else. Here's a guy who was only a famous movie star who served his time. Well, why the heck does he rate a burial next to all these colonels? Well, following is the amazing answer. I always liked Lee Marvin, but he didn't know the extent, but I didn't know the extent of his core experiences. In a time when many Hollywood stars served their country in the armed forces, often in rear echelon posts where they were carefully protected, only to be trotted out to perform for the cameras in war bond promotions, Lee Marvin was a genuine hero. He won the Navy Cross at Iwo Jima. There was only one higher naval award, which is the Medal of Honor. If that is a surprising comment on the true character of the man, he credits his sergeant with an even greater show of bravery. He did an interview with Johnny Carson many years ago, and here's some dialogue from that interview. Johnny said, Lee, I bet a lot of people are unaware that you were a Marine in the initial landing at Iwo Jima, and that during the course of that action you earned the Navy Cross and were severely wounded. Yeah, I got shot square in the bottom and they gave me the cross for securing a hot spot about halfway up Suribachi. Bad thing about getting shot up on a mountain is guys getting shot hauling you down. But Johnny, at Iwo, I served under the bravest man I ever knew. We both got the cross the same day, but what he did for his cross made mine look cheap in comparison. That dumb guy actually stood up on Red Beach and directed his troops to move forward and get the hell off the beach. Bullets flying by with mortar rounds landing everywhere, and he stood there as the main target of gunfire so that he could get his men to safety. He did this on more than one occasion because his men's safety was more important than his own life. That sergeant and I have been lifelong friends. When they brought me off Suribachi, we passed the sergeant, and he lit a smoke and passed it to me. Lying on my belly on the litter, I guess that's like a gurney or something, and said, Where'd they get you, Lee? Well, Bob, if you make it home before me, tell my mom to sell the outhouse. Johnny, I'm not lying. Sergeant Keeshan was the bravest man I ever knew. The sergeant's name is Bob Keeshan. You and the world know him as Captain Kangaroo. So it goes on to tell a story about Mr. Rogers that I'm not going to read. Everybody always wondered why he wore a sweater, and it was because he was tattooed and he had been a Presbyterian minister. I don't want to convolute the rest of the story with something that I've been told isn't true. But the last paragraph is wonderful. America's real heroes don't flaunt what they did. They quietly go about their day-to-day lives doing what they do best. They earned our respect and the freedoms that we all enjoy. Look around and see if you can find one of those heroes in your midst. Often they are the ones you'd least expect. But you would most like to have on your side if anything ever happened. Just saying. So isn't that a great story?
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And when you hear stories like that, it really makes you, you know, reassess the contributions that people make. You know, like, this is one of the reasons why you should never judge another person. You're standing in front of somebody, you're looking at a movie, at an actor on a TV show or a performer up on stage, and people make all kinds of judgments about them without knowing what they've done with their life, what challenges they've experienced, what contributions they've made. They know nothing about the value of this person, you know, and yet because maybe they do something goofy one day and they're caught by the cameras, or they do something on stage, or they in a movie that you don't think is up to par, and you devalue them based on your reaction to a little snippet of time without looking at the value of the entirety of their lives. And I think that's when we diminish ourselves, when we do that.
Well, and I also think that you never know the strength of anybody or the inner core of anybody until they're put in a place to test it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would imagine in the whole big world, there's lots of heroes walking around.
Mm-hmm.
But until they've had the opportunity to put their cape on, nobody knows it.
Right. And I've seen a lot of people that if they go through some sort of a crisis, and like you said, that's when you see their true character, because you see how they rise to the occasion, you see how they deal with it, how they maintain themselves. And it's like, it's always funny, like, I see some people go through crises and become real jerks. Like, they blame the rest of the world because now they're going through this thing, whatever they're experiencing. And it always surprises me because they use this bad thing as a reason for acting badly. And I look at them sometimes and I say, you know, you don't know me. How do you know that something 10 times worse than that ever happened to me and I'm treating you nice? You know, just because something bad happens to you doesn't give you the right to then be nasty or a jerk to other people. And that's when you really see the character of somebody. I've seen people who had really, really, you know, challenging, awful things happen to them, and yet they stay kind, they stay respectful. You know, they don't take it out on the world because this thing is happening to them. They rise to it. They strengthen themselves. They take a deep breath and get through it and still try to see the good in their lives. And then you see other people that have very little challenges to deal with, and they seem to go into major victim mode, and like everybody else is responsible somehow for this thing that you know, in many cases they brought into their own lives. So it's interesting that these type of situations can either make the character of a person if they respond to it, or can actually diminish them because they react in a way that doesn't rise to the occasion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like, yeah, well, that's all true, and the fact that there's still the, you know, you always have to look at the flip side of that. There's still the opportunity that you are faced with a situation where you can either stand up or sit down. And you make a decision, and say you decide to stand up and really don't know what you're doing. So then you have all these groups of people that pass judgment on you again. Just because you have the stamina and the heart and the chutzpah to take a stand for something doesn't always mean you're right. And very sadly, that good person whose good intentions and who wants to be of some assistance ends up looking like, that's not what their intent was. And then you get all the judgmentality from that. You know, what the hell did you do that for? I mean, you know, that you made things worse. I mean, how many times have you seen a situation like that? Millions, right, in your lifetime?
All the time.
But the point is the person who stands up, the next time they stand up, they may really be in a place where they're suited to fix that. The point is not being afraid to stand up. We all make mistakes, and sometimes your solutions or your answers or your ideas to make something better don't always work. It doesn't mean you're supposed to quit trying, I don't think. I think every time you do something, it just tells everybody who you really are, somebody who cares.
That famous quote by Teddy Roosevelt where he talks about the guy who's in the arena and standing up and falling down and getting bloodied and all that. But he honors that person because at least they're out there. Even if they fall down over and over again, they're falling down while they're putting out the effort to make a difference. And he values that person more than the person that sits on the sidelines criticizing him and doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because it's easy. That's easy. And and hindsight, or once something is already, once somebody's blown up the balloon, taken the job to blow up the balloon and set it afloat, and everybody else goes, you could have blown that balloon up bigger, or why did you pick that color for that balloon, or you didn't tie the knot right, everybody then is an authority, right?
Right.
We see that every day in so many different arenas, every single day. But you're the one who picked it up, blew it up, and sent it afloat. So that's what you should be applauded for, not for the fact that maybe somebody else could have done it better. It's the fact that you stood up and did it. You know, in our armed forces, and, of course, we talked about this on Veterans Day or Memorial Day or one of those days, we talked a lot about the armed forces. But when you think about the people that have made that their life, who have gone in and nobody ever knows about them. It doesn't make it. I mean, the only person that I ever remember always being on the front page of the paper if they were in the armed forces of any kind was Elvis Presley and, people like that who everybody thought were, really big heroes because they went and did it. Or how about all of the people who applauded for all those years? Bob Hope. Yes, he deserved applause. He went on into the fighting arenas, the front lines from everything I've ever read about him. But he got all the attention, and I don't want to take that away. But when I weigh Bob Hope versus the 20-year-old guy that's been out there watching his friends get shot and ducking his head from bullets and walking on landmines and laying in the mud and stuff like that. Is there any comparison between those two people, what they gave or what they could do? There isn't, of course. But Bob Hope, was still a hero in all of our eyes because he brought some relief and some joy to those that were over there doing it. But you knew Bob Hope's name, but you didn't know that 20-year-old's name unless you were his mom.
Right.
So we do struggle with the way we see things and the way we recognize things. But I thought, I got this story a while back, and I've read it a couple times. And, of course, I always loved Lee Marvin. And, of course, I grew up with Captain Kangaroo and Mr. Green Jeans and Mr. Moose and Bunny Rabbit and all those. All of you people are out there thinking, God, how old is Rainey?
I grew up with Captain Kangaroo, too. And Lee Marvin is one of my favorite actors as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also like...
Do you remember when Lee Marvin was in Cat Ballou?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And him and his horse would get drunk together all the time?
Yep, yep.
I never laughed so hard in my life. The first time I saw him and that horse leaning up against the side of the building like they were both drunk, I can still see that in my mind's eye. Big Spike and I went to the drive-in to see that. I never laughed so hard in my life. And of course, in a lot of Lee Marvin's roles, he was, you know, a tough guy, a gangsta, and all that kind of stuff. But I loved that, and it just gave you a taste of, you know,
and I loved
what he
voice.
Was capable of doing. Yeah, me too. Me too.
A very
great voice.
Quite, yeah.
And to believe that mild-mannered Captain Kangaroo, who walked around with that silly haircut and let ping pong balls drop on his head and made a face, was in charge of all these young men and saved all their lives time and time again, according to that report. It's hard to put those two people in the same body, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and again, that might have been a choice of his because of everything he saw. He might have wanted to go into something that was more innocent and lighthearted and for children just to be able to cope with. I mean, if he was on the front lines like that, he must have seen a lot of awful stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think they did. I think in all of our wars, the heaviness, the heartbreak, the tragedy and trauma, a lot of people try to put it into words. A lot of people write books about it every day, and I don't know. If you look at the videos that we have from 911 and you look at the videos that we have from the Boston thing, the marathon and the bombing and all that kind of stuff, and you see the fear and you see the disorganized fear of people running and trampling each other and just trying to get to safety. And then the next night on the news, they show a school hallway with all the kids lined up, crouched down on their bellies, covering their heads with the new bulletproof blankets over them. And you sit there and try to imagine, how the hell did we get here?
Exactly.
All these other people that have died to keep us safe, died for our freedom, lost limbs for our freedom to keep us in a place that is free and safe and civilized with morals, like we talk about on Bullies to Buddies. And yet we see these things all the time. Yesterday in the hospital, Mike and I watched some news about all the stuff that's going on and the president talking about Iraq and Iran and all these different things that are going on. And, of course, they keep showing all these very dramatic clips. And I thought to myself, you know, I don't get it. How can we get to these places when all everybody wants is the same thing? They all want to get up this morning, have a cup of coffee, kiss their family goodbye, go do a job that they earn enough money to pay for the house and the electricity and the car that they're driving. I mean, how many of us want much more than that? Not too many, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that's what's going on all over the world. It's like you want to reach out and shake the whole planet. Excuse me, is everybody paying attention to what the hell is going on? And then in all the little corners of the world, you have people like my son sitting in a hospital who almost died Friday. And now his life has moved on to a different place, and he has still a lot of stuff, and his life was never real easy to begin with. And yet he's fighting his own private fight. And how many people are out there fighting their own private fight? We know. that there's millions, right? And yet Excellent. When we get the opportunity to be okay and we're not in a struggle like that, then we behave like, you know, idiots. It's just hard for me to, I want to say, you know, look at everybody and say, what are you thinking? Why are you doing this? Wouldn't it be nicer to be able to live with each other in peace? Doesn't mean, you know, that everybody you're going to run into, you fall desperately in love with. That's not the point. But the respect, the morals, all that kind of stuff has to come into play sometime. And all these power mongers who want to be in charge, why do you want to be in charge? Why? I've never talked to a CEO of a big company who has told me that they wanted to be in charge because they wanted to just be in charge. They want to be in charge because they want to make more money. They want to be the boss. All the wrong reasons, Shelley. All the wrong reasons.
So what's the right reason?
I think the right reason is to make things better. To make, you can live comfortably. That's okay. I'm not taking that away from anybody. But if you're in charge, if you're the boss, then you should be making sure that everybody else is living comfortably too, because that's the moral thing to do.
Right, right.
Not step on all their heads because they're beneath you.
Exactly.
And that seems
yep.
to be what our countries are doing to each other. You know, I have all mm-hmm. these crazy young men who are willing to go out there and be maimed and lose their lives and leave their families fatherless and motherless just to fight because I told them to. I mean, what makes people like that different from Hitler?
That's one of the things that's kind of disturbing when you look at war scenarios and you look at the people that are making the decision to go to war, you know, and they're sitting in war rooms and conference rooms and making decisions to send 20-year-olds out to kill each other, basically. You know, and it's a disturbing repetition that's been happening for thousands of years on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, for me, it should be a lot more about the good things and the things that we can do for each other and the things we can do to make other people's lives more comfortable and better. And in this story, it sounds like Bob Keeshan, Captain Kangaroo, was one of those kind of men. He was more concerned about keeping the men that depended on him to make the right decisions in a good place. And that just keeps climbing up that ladder. You know, that's in a family, mom and dad are supposed to make those good decisions. And then, you know, then you move into workplaces and then you move into government. And you, as you go up those ladders of authority, that's the way you look at the person that's in charge. You want to believe that they're not just thinking about themselves, that they're thinking about everybody. How many movies do we watch? Some of them are even comedies where the owner of a great big company makes all these decisions and is rich beyond belief and decides one Christmas to not give Christmas bonuses to all the families. I mean, we make a joke of it. We make
right.
a joke of that boorish,
like whole,
self-centered behavior.
Thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're thinking of the Griswold Family Vacation. Or Christmas or something like that, where the goofy brother-in-law kidnaps the boss of Chevy Chase's boss where he works because he doesn't get his Christmas bonus and the whole family is depending on it. But it's, you know, they make it be funny. Or Fun with Dick and Jane, where they turn to Robin Banks because they get fired and they find out that their boss, his boss, is, you know, robbing the company blind. And we make a joke of all those things, and yet they're really, really happening in real life every day.
That's right. Yep, you got higher-ups.
You know,
look at the bank bailout. That's like a prime example. You know, here they get all this government assistance to bail out, and what do? They give huge bonuses to a lot of the higher-ups sending guys on vacation. And meanwhile, the rest of us, when do we get a bailout when we screw up? You know, why were the banks given a bailout and not restriction on how that bailout money was supposed to be used? You know, it was like a windfall for them, but in a way that it wasn't meant to. But they weren't supposed to use that to give bonuses to people. That was supposed to get them out of trouble because they screwed up, quite bluntly. You know.
Yeah, and then they could have taken that bailout money, helped all the employees that struggled or went without vacations or did any of that kind of stuff, and they could have taken some of those empty houses that they've been paid for more than once now, a lot more money than they ever handed over, and give them to people that can't afford to have a home. There's a million things that they could have done that were more conducive to making the world a better place, period.
Right.
And they didn't.
That's right.
It still had to be all about how much more money can we get out of this little old farmhouse. We took it away from the Brown family, and then the White family, they bought it, and then the Mr. and Mrs. Green, then they bought it, and now we've collected money four times over for this little farmhouse. It was never worth what the original people paid for it. And yet,
right.
there it can sit empty. And nobody else can get an opportunity to have it because it's tied up in all the crap, you know. I mean, I thought to myself yesterday, I named in my own head how many people I know are struggling, not just with their health, because there's millions of them as well, but there's people that are in foreclosure. There's people that are caught up in living someplace where they know they're not going to be able to live forever because everything has just fallen apart behind them. Not the walls of their house, luckily, so they still have shelter, but eventually they won't have any of that and nothing to show for all the money, effort, time, and love that they put into that home. Nothing. And it's not just two or three people. It's millions of people. So
right.
instead of fixing that, stepping up and saying something, or how about the $10? I'm really on a soapbox today. I think I'm probably angry about everything that's going on with Mike, so I'm going to take it out on everybody today. So it's kind of like you look around you and you think to yourself, why do we have people that are so unbelievably wealthy and rich and can do whatever they want, and then we have so many people who can't afford to feed their kids. And then they're arguing over $10 an hour minimum wage, which will take 3 years to manifest. And what's $10 an hour, Shell? $400 a week. That means that's what your mortgage should be, $400 a month.
Right, right. And unfortunately, there are powers that be that are way up in the food chain making decisions to make sure that the masses are always in a state of not ever really being able to get ahead, because that's how they can create a workforce. If you're comfortable and you have a lot of money, you don't need to be in the workforce. They need to make sure that they have a workforce out there to support them. And there's people in power. Remember, we have 7 billion people on the face of the planet. 7,000 people are billionaires that control the world. 7,000. So what is that, a point of a percent or something like that? You know, it's something like, you know, 1% of the population or 3% of the population, something like that. I think it's 1% of the population controls 97% of the wealth in the world. Think about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with that, and it's kind of like I said, I envision myself standing out there and just shaking the whole world and getting everybody to pay attention. You know, I don't know what you're thinking, but of course it happens on a small scale, a medium scale, an extra large scale, and a jumbo scale. Really, you know, I mean, there's like a million different entities to all of the things that are so screwed up. Every now and then when somebody writes me something and tells me how really happy they are and how things are going right for them, and I think, to you know, I often say, really, what's going on? Well, you know, my daughter just got married, and it's always the little things, Shelley. Nobody ever says to me, I just got, you know, $100,000 a year raise. Nobody ever says that to me. They tell me about the little things. Or
right.
My daughter just gave birth to my first grandchild. My husband and I got a weekend getaway. We didn't go to Paris. We did a weekend getaway. It's always the little things. Always,
uh-huh.
always the little things. And yet, you know, I don't know whether that's true because we placate ourselves with the little things. There's maybe a little truth to that, but isn't that okay? It seems to me like it's okay.
Sure.
I mean, I can remember as a teenager being happy when my hair came out the way I liked it. Now, how little a thing can you, I mean, that would make my day if I got up in the morning and my hair looked the way I thought it was supposed to look. That was a great day.
Right. But I don't know that I would use the word placate, because when I think about the little things, spending time with family and things like that, I mean, a perfect example for me is like last year I went to Germany to see my nephew, but the value of that, although it was cultural and exciting to travel into Europe and all that, was spending all that exciting time with my family. I mean, I was there to see Derek and his wife and his two kids, and it was just an incredible adventure. But I have just as much fun. Like last night, my sister and I went over to my niece's house with her and her husband, and we played cards. And that was thrilling also. So it's like there are different types of memories. There are different types of fun. But the last night was just as uplifting as when I went to Paris. I mean, we just had a blast. We sat around for hours laughing and playing cards, and it was really, it really bolsters you when you spend time with family and friends, and it doesn't always have to cost you money to really, really uplift you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the things that do cost money, great. If you've got it, spend it. If you don't have it, find other ways to, you know, don't sit there feeling sorry for yourself and saying, I can't go to Paris. You know, say to yourself, oh, you know, I can go to the beach today and walk along the water and look at the beautiful ocean. There's so many ways we can uplift ourselves.
Well, and that's all true, and that's good advice to everybody, for sure. When I said placate, I mean, you know, make themselves believe that it's okay if they can't pay the mortgage, as you know, but the little things are what's keeping you afloat. When I say the word placate, I don't mean change the truth or make it more important to, you know, enjoy a weekend getaway instead of being able to pay the mortgage. I don't mean that. I mean, convince yourself that the little things are what keep you happy, but you feel like the big things are elusive. It's a mindset. It's not a fact. So it's like, you know, making yourself think, well, you know, I can't, you know, the car's falling apart and I can't afford a new car and I can't do this. But, you know, I am having a new grandchild. And, of course, the grandchild is a million times more important in the big picture than the new car. I think everybody gets that. But for me, the word placate means, you know, convince yourself that you're taking strength from the good things. I don't mean it as a bad thing. So if somebody misunderstood what I meant by that, I don't mean it as a bad thing. I just mean it as keeping yourself in a good place. By saying, you know, that's great. You know, there's a man that's on Facebook all the time, and I really don't remember him, but he grew up with Big Spike, and he lives on a farm. And I wish I knew him better, because every day he starts out, it's so beautiful out here today. I'm haying, and he's in his 60s, and I'm haying, and the sun is shining, and I'm going to set up some stuff for my wife today because we're going to make dinner together and everything. And I thought to myself, you know, here's a happy guy. He's a happy guy, and it's not about the big stuff. He's just a happy guy.
Right.
I love to read his posts because I never hear him say anything bad about anybody else. I never hear him complain about anybody else. It's always about what he's going to do himself today to make his day good.
Wow.
And what a lesson that is. What a lesson, right?
Yep.
But I do want to say, though, in regard to that story and in regard to some of the things that are going on in my personal life, there are heroes everywhere around us. And just because they're not on TV every night and everybody thinks that they're a hero because they did this or they did that, there's heroes in every aspect of your life. And I think it's a gift to yourself if you can look for them and recognize them. And it could be the person, you know, the friend you have that you only talk to once in a while, but whenever you talk to them, they make you laugh.
Right.
In your personal life, that's a big thing. That's a good thing. That person is a hero to you. I've met a new friend recently that I'm going to be involved in with Desert Rose, and which is an organization that helps people with addictions, all ages of people, children, middle-aged, older adults, everybody. And the whole mission statement of this place is to help people until they're really and truthfully not standing with crutches, not standing with a cane, but standing by themselves, and see them through to that. Don't send them out the door with crutches and say, okay, now you're good to go, because you're not.
Right.
So this company, these people that I've met are amazing, and one of them is a young man. He has a family and everything, and I was supposed to meet with everybody Saturday morning, and, of course, because of what was going on with Mike, I couldn't. He sent me the most beautiful sentiment in a text, and I thought to myself, see, now people like this, they get it. They really get it. And every time I meet somebody, of course, I'm lucky because I have quite a few people like that. But I also have quite a few people that I love dearly that don't have any idea what I'm talking about when I say things like that. So you have that to contend with as well, you know.
Right.
But most of the people that I have in my life really care about other people and want to make a difference. And there's no such thing as helping somebody halfway. No such thing. If you're going to say you're going to help somebody, you help them all the way. I don't believe I have a sentiment that I share a lot. I'll give you my hand. I can't carry you. I have all I can do to carry Rainey. But I can give you my hand and hold your hand, and we'll walk together.
Oh, that's nice. I like that.
Well, and that's the way it should be, right? Because you don't want somebody to be so dependent on you that they can't walk by themselves, right?
That's exactly. So, well, you know, we talk about Oz. We're going to do that another day this week?
Oh, well, you know, it's all, yeah, we will. But it's kind of an amusing, it's kind of an amusing story. But it's in the 1890s is when they wrote Oz. And it's, everything is supposed to be, there's supposed to be a hidden meaning behind all the characters, the search for the great and powerful Oz. It's very interesting. So, yes, I thought maybe Thursday, because the more I, well, we've been talking this morning, the more I search into it, I thought, oh, Shelley and I will talk about this for 4 hours easily. So, but, yeah, so today we're almost out of time. I want to say that I did get a text from my daughter-in-law, Valerie, and it looks as though Mike may be in the hospital for a little while longer. I don't have all the facts yet, but I will make sure everybody is updated tomorrow, and I want to thank everybody ahead of time for their prayers and their good thoughts for Michael. And tomorrow we will do the Bullies to Buddies show, and we'll work out of the workbook. But as usual, it usually pulls us into lots of other arenas because it always pertains to so much that's going on in our lives. I also want to send some good wishes out to Carrie, who did get some good news this past week, but now things are like in that legal limbo, I like to call it. And,
right.
But eventually, I think she, too, will see light at the end of her tunnel, and things will work out the way they're supposed to for her. So we'll send out some good wishes for her and anybody else who's struggling, you know. look past all the struggle and look for something that makes you smile, and you'll get through it somehow, some way. We always do. So
yep.
God bless everybody. Have a great day. It's really sunny out there right now, but probably the heavens will open up this afternoon. So have a great day, everybody. Thanks a lot. Thanks, honey. Talk to you soon.
Hey, thanks, Renee. I'll talk to you in a little bit. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.